So before we begin, I know we've been going through kind of in a, I don't want to say a rush, but we've been really moving quickly here through the last couple chapters, and part of that is because we are trying to finish up before the summer, but the other part of that is just a lot of this material we've seen already. We've seen similar ideas, we've seen similar themes, so a lot of it isn't really new. It's stuff that we've you guys are a little bit familiar with. But before we dive into our text for tonight, is there anything you guys have questions or comments about, something that you're unclear, or even things you're clear about, or maybe just some observations you guys have about the book of Revelation so far, or yeah, just anything you want to say? Okay. Oh, okay, good. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. Hey, nice job. Congrats. With three chapters to go, you got done with Hitchcock. You know what? Dr. Hitchcock was just given some kind of honor at the seminary. There was something at the chapel, I think. They mentioned something about Dr. Hitchcock. Can't remember what it was. But anyways, yeah. So, all right. Oh, no, he won an award, I think, for one of the most popular teachers or something, I think. But anyways, so we're in chapter 20 tonight. We got three chapters left in the Revelation, and it's material that, like I said before, we've already seen some of this stuff. We've already discussed a lot of the themes that are going to be here. But things are going to have a lot of events that are going to be really short. So we've seen in Revelation how, and we've seen in the Bible, you guys all know the Bible well enough, sometimes a very small event, in as far as time goes, takes up a huge amount of length of the Bible, and sometimes you're just moving zip, zap, zop through the Bible, through the timeline of what's actually happening really quickly. This section is going to kind of do a little bit of that. We're going to see things really slow down and things really speed up, and so the last couple chapters are really interesting, at least as far as that goes, and for other reasons. But I think what we'll do tonight, chapter 20 is a shorter chapter, so I think we'll read the whole chapter, and then we'll take, I want to hear you guys' initial comments, your initial thoughts, and then we'll start going verse by verse, because that's kind of our default method, but I think that'll work better for chapter 20. So, chapter 20, reading out of my translation, you can read out of whatever you want. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain upon his hand, and he held the dragon, the from the beginning serpent, which is devil and the Satan. And he bound him 1,000 years and cast him into the abyss and closed and sealed over it so that he should not still deceive the nations until the 1,000 years should be finished. After this, it is necessary to loose him a small time. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them, and the souls of the ones who are beheaded on account of the testimony of Jesus and on account of the word of God, and such as who did not worship the beast, neither his image, and did not take the mark upon the forehead and upon their hand, and they lived, and they kinged with Christ 1,000 years. The remaining of the dead did not live until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one having part in the first resurrection. Upon these, the second death does not have authority, but they will be priests of God and of the Christ, and will king with him 1,000 years. And when 1,000 years are finished, the Satan will be loosed out of his prison, and he will go out to deceive the nations, the ones in the four corners of the earth, the Gog and Magog, to gather them into the war, of which the number of them is like the sand of the sea. And they went up upon the plains of the earth and are encircled about the fortified camp of the holies and the loved city, and fire came down out of heaven and ate them up. And the devil, the one who is deceiving them, was cast into the lake of fire and sulfur, where also the beast and the false prophet are. And they will be tormented day and night into the ages of the ages. And I saw a great white throne, and the one sitting upon it, which from his face the earth and the heaven fled, and a place was not found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, are stood before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of the things that are written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave the dead in it, and the death and the Hades gave the dead in them, and each were judged according to their works. And the death and the Hades were cast into the lake of fire. And if someone was not found written in the book of life, he was cast into the lake of fire. Okay, several events that John covers really rapidly. John covers 1,000 years in about a sentence, right? So we've got some things that we've got a couple major events, and all of these are definitely last time events. So here's kind of where we're sitting. So remember way back when we started Revelation, I said there are primarily four views in how people interpret the book of Revelation. There are more than four, but for convenience sake, there are four views. There is the preterist view, which is everything in the book of Revelation, with the exception of some of this stuff, has already happened. The preterist view is everything, except some of them would say some of this stuff hasn't happened yet, but almost everything in chapters 1 through 19 have already happened. Then there is the historicist view. The historicist view is all of this is taking place throughout history. So that John was making a prophecy. John was talking about all of this stuff as future, or at least a lot of it as future from his point of view, but it's not future for us. Some of this is being played out through history, and some of it has already happened. Okay. There is the spiritualist view, which is similar to the historicist view, which is all of the things in the book of Revelation are spiritual. They are symbolic, they're metaphorical, they're parables, and they symbolize spiritual truth, but they don't actually symbolize anything in the real world. Well, they do symbolize something in the real world, but you can't take this literally. You have to have the right keys of interpretation to understand what the symbols represent, and then you can kind of make sense of it. And then there's the futurist view, which is the view I hold and the view I teach from, which is all of this material from chapter 4 onwards is yet future. This is all future. None of this has happened yet, because almost all futurists, that's not true, not almost all. Many futurists believe that the rapture is the line of demarcation. When the rapture happens, the events of the tribulation begin. All futurists would agree that from chapter 4 onwards, those things don't happen until the tribulation. So they would say that some tribulation in the future has to happen. So we're not actually in the book of Revelation until the tribulation begins, until that 7-year period. So that's the futurists. Now here's where almost all the groups agree. Almost all the groups agree, and everybody who's not a heretic, and I use that word advisedly, everybody who does not teach a heresy agrees that chapter 20 has not happened yet. Because the end of chapter 19 and chapter 20 is dealing with the last judgment and the return of Christ. And they should be in the other order. It should be the return of Christ, the 1,000-year reign, and the last judgment. Now, if you're a Lutheran or a Catholic or a whole bunch of people, that 1,000 years, you believe that you're in the 1,000 years right now. Lutherans, anybody who's an amillennialist, that is people that don't believe in a millennium, they don't believe in a literal 1,000-year reign, that's an amillennial, meaning not, millennial meaning millennium. So anybody who's, like I said, Lutherans, at least officially Lutherans, lots of Catholics, I don't actually know if that's the official position of the Catholic Church. I think it might be, but I'm not sure. A lot of Reformed people, so that would be some of your Reformed Baptists, but they tend to go another way. A lot of your more liberal Christian churches, so a lot of your liberal denominations, Methodists and stuff like that, they're going to be amillennial. But typically your amillennialists are from your major denominations and your major old school denominations and tend to be your conservative major old school denominations. So Lutherans, Anglicans, some Catholics, some Reformed, those guys. They don't believe there's a millennium. So they believe that the thousand-year reign, that's happening right now. That the church reigning on earth, that is the 1,000 years. Now, they believe that Jesus Christ will return again, that Christ will come again to judge the living and the dead. If you don't believe that, you're not a Christian. You're a heretic, because the Nicene Creed, what the Christian church has believed since always, is that we believe that Jesus Christ is going to come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end. That's what all Christians have always agreed on. We disagree about when, and we disagree about what. But here in chapter 20, we agree, everybody agrees that most of this stuff hasn't happened yet. Now, there's another group, so you have your amillennialists. People say, nope, there's no millennium. There's no millennial reign of Jesus. It's just a symbol. It doesn't mean anything literal. Then you have what are called post-millennialists. Post-millennialists, as you can guess from the prefix post, believe that Jesus will return after the millennium. So what they believe, and these are traditionally are going to be your hardcore Reformed people, so your Reformed Baptists, your Presbyterians, Calvinists, Calvinists of many, if not all, stripes, a lot of Anabaptists and liberal Methodists, and a lot of the more liberal evangelical wing tends to swing this way. And because they believe that the church is going to bring in the kingdom, that what happens is God's work throughout history is going to cause the church to have influence throughout the whole world, and the whole world will be Christianized. And that will bring in a kingdom, and that after that kingdom has reigned to such a degree that the whole world has been Christianized, Jesus will return. That's your post-millennialists. Again, they agree that this is future. There's no post-millennialist in the world who believes that we are in, that Jesus has returned. So they believe that this is future. And then you have premillennialists, people like me, who believe that Jesus will return before the millennium. Now, the reason that premillennialists like me believe that Jesus will return before the millennium is because that's how the book's written. Chapter 19 comes before chapter 20. So, you know, call me crazy. I just believe that reading things in order is a good policy. But anyways, I'm just taking stabs at people that aren't here. So everybody who's not a heretic agrees that what we're reading about here is future, is still future. So we've entered a really interesting part of the book of Revelation. We're now in a place where everybody agrees this hasn't happened yet. Now, we don't all agree on what it means, but we all agree it hasn't happened yet. Okay, now that was a really long introduction to this, but what do you guys see? Here in chapter 20, it was 15 verses. What stands out to you? What do you guys think is really important, really worth understanding? Or maybe you just thought it was interesting. Yeah, okay, so what is Gog and Magog? Let's just turn there right now, because we're going to have to cover it anyways, and since you asked it, and that's the part that most people are really interested in. Let's turn with me to Ezekiel chapter 38. I'm not going to read all of chapters 38 and 39 of Ezekiel, because frankly, we just don't have that kind of time. But you can read it on your own, and I would highly recommend it. So Ezekiel, the later chapters of Ezekiel, we've already mentioned these when we were back in chapter 10 or 11, where I believe that, you know, there's a great earthquake in Jerusalem. People believe, and all of Jerusalem seems to be converted. And, you know, the second half of the tribulation begins. I believe that's a fulfillment of Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones. So what happens in Ezekiel is beginning in chapter 36, there is a series of prophecies that pretty much everybody agrees are eschatological. They're referring to the end times. And this continues all the way through the end of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel's not a short book. So really from chapter 36 to Ezekiel 48, all of this is Ezekiel writing about stuff that almost everybody agrees is end time stuff. It's apocalyptic. It's the end of everything. Now, in Ezekiel, he writes about the Valley of Dry Bones, chapter 37, you know, the Son of Man, can these bones live? Well, you alone know, Lord. And then, you know, prophesy to the bones, Son of Man. And Ezekiel prophesies to the bones, and the bones come together. And then then he prophesies to the bones again, and then the bones come to life, and they stand up, and they're a mighty army. And this happens. And then in chapter in verse 15, we read about the reunion of Israel and Judah. Israel and Judah are reunited. Then in chapter 38, we find out about Gog. Chapter 38, this is another message that came to me from the Lord. This is Ezekiel speaking. And the prophecy was, "Son of man, prophesy against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince who rules over the nations of Meshech and Tubal. Give him this message from the sovereign Lord. I am your enemy. I will turn around and put hooks into your jaws and lead you out to destruction," et cetera, et cetera. It keeps going, and he talks about how Gog, that this prince of Magog, is going to be destroyed, and he's going to invade the land of Israel, and he's going to be destroyed. And then we see chapter 39, "Son of man, prophesy against Gog. Give him this message from the sovereign Lord. I am your enemy, O Gog, ruler of the nations of Meshech and Tubal." Okay, well, that seems to be, that's exactly how we introduced it the first time, right? So he's using the same phraseology. And he says, "I will turn you and drive you toward the mountains of Israel to bring you from the distant north." And he's saying how he's going to bring him into this war. But then what's going to happen is, in verse 11, "I will make a vast graveyard for Gog and his hordes in the Valley of Travelers, east of the Dead Sea. The path of those who travel will be blocked by this burial ground, and they will change the name to the Valley of Gog's Hordes. It will take 7 months for the people of Israel to cleanse the land by burying the bodies. Everyone in Israel will help, for it will be a glorious victory for Israel when I demonstrate my glory on that day, says the sovereign Lord. At the end of 7 months, special crews will be appointed to search the land for skeletons and bury them." And then they say how they're going to, they're going to have this great battle, and things are going to, they're going to burn the weaponry. I think that's that might be earlier, where you talk about they're going to use the weaponry to burn that, and they're going to burn that for fuel. Okay, so there's this in the Old Testament. Now, Gog and Magog, who are they? Lots of theories out there. The going theory for a long time was that Gog and Magog are the Russian people. There's a place where I believe Gog is referred to as the Prince of Rosh, and Rosh can mean the head in Hebrew. Other people say that that's the historical name for Russia. I'm not super sold on that argument. I'm not sure that I totally buy it, but a lot of people have associated it with the Russians in the north. There are a couple problems with this theory. One is the Russians didn't exist at this time. The Russians were not an ethnic people that existed at the time that John wrote this. Certainly not at the time Ezekiel wrote this. So the modern-day Russians are a combination of a couple people groups. They're a mixture of the Scythians, who were barbarian hordesmen. This is one of the theories anyways. They're a mixture of the Scythians. They're a mixture of some of the Eastern peoples, but primarily a lot of their ethnic heritage comes from Vikings, from the Scandinavians who went down into Ukraine in Kiev, and they founded the Kievan Rus. And those people, the Rus, the Russian people, Rus, Russia, they expanded and began to take over the Russian plains. They expanded beyond Ukraine. And then, so you have like a bunch of people who are ethnically Russian. You have Ukrainians who are ethnically Russian. They're called Little Russians. You have Russia Russians who are called Big Russians. You have Belarusians who are White Russians. I think they're also Black Russians and Red Russians, and I don't remember which countries they come from, but it doesn't matter. Here's the point. If this is a prophecy about Russia, we should not expect there to be a verbal clue that tells us that it's Russia, because Russia didn't exist. They didn't exist for a very long time. So if this is Russia, which that's a good theory, I'm not against that, but if this is referring to the land of Russia, then we shouldn't expect to find really good evidence of it. Again, because Russia didn't exist. Does it refer to Russia? I don't know. I don't even remember what Dr. Hitchcock says, honestly, but a lot of guys, you guys might remember, John Hagee was big on that, and who was the other guy? Jack Van Impe. Did you guys ever see Jack Van Impe? Okay, Deanne's kind of nodding her head. She vaguely remembers. Jack Van Impe was huge about that. That was his whole shtick, was that there was going to be a coming war with Russia and that Russia was Gog and Magog. And you can look into his stuff. I don't know that I'd put a whole lot of stock in what Jack Van Impe says, but hey, he was out there saying it. And anyways, so that's a long introduction. Who is Gog and Magog? We don't know. But Ezekiel suggests that there is going to be a war. Now, Adrian Rogers, Dr. Hitchcock, and a lot of other people believe that there will be two wars of Gog and Magog, that there will be two times when this war happens, and that basically what happens is here in chapter 20, the first war of Gog and Magog was so bad that they call the second one the War of Gog and Magog as well. And people, kind of like how we call it World War I and World War II, that's kind of the theory. I don't really like that theory. I don't have a better one, so I hold on to that one very, very loosely. We don't know. I guess that's the best answer I have for you. I'm trying to give you a bunch of background information so at least you know some of the ideas that are out there, but we don't know. Here's what we do know. Here's what we do know about Gog and Magog. After the thousand-year reign of Jesus is over, people go to war against God. That's what's happening here. So we'll get to that in just a moment, because that, to me, is the interesting thing. I don't care if it's China or Russia or America or Saudi Arabia. I don't really care who Gog and Magog are. Well, I do care, but I don't care that much. I care a lot more about what this says about what God is doing throughout history. So anybody else have any other like major things you want to talk about before we dive into the verse-by-verse study of the text? All right, well, if you think of it, just interrupt me. I will not be insulted. Okay, so John has seen this. John has seen that Christ has returned. He has defeated Antichrist and the false prophet. He has cast them into the lake of fire. Satan is still hanging out doing his thing. We'll have to deal with Satan in a second. The armies are destroyed. The armies of Antichrist are destroyed. So the world has basically been changed an awful lot. And then we see what happens. So the war is won. The battle is won. Those who are attacking the city of Jerusalem are defeated, because that's what's happening. They're attacking the city of Jerusalem. And if we go back to chapter, someday I'll learn math. If we go back to chapter 19, we'll see that. And then if we go back to Daniel, we see what do they do? The prince who exalts himself will surround the Holy Land, and he will attack the people of God. And that's a lot of people, and I'm one of them, believe that that's referring to what happens in chapter 19. Is that Antichrist is going to come, he's going to surround Jerusalem, he's going to prepare for a major war there, either because he's attacking Jerusalem or because his enemies happen to be coming to meet him there. We don't know entirely, but that's what's happening. He's destroyed, his army is destroyed, and then an angel comes out of heaven having the key of the abyss and a great chain upon his hand. And he held the dragon, and it's interesting, he's called the From the Beginning Serpent. Now, I translated that painfully literally, that he's the From the Beginning Serpent. And the reason I did that is because your Bible probably says something like the ancient serpent. The word is archaios, so I know that, Mark, you like archaeology, right? So archaios, it's where we get the word archaeology from. So he's an ancient serpent. Now, why is that significant? Well, because who's Jesus? In the beginning, in the arche was the word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. That word arche means beginning, it can mean ruler, but that's a word that's often associated with Jesus. So the fact that he's called the ancient serpent with this word, he could have used the word paleos. Paleos means ancient or very old as well, but he chooses this word, archaios. He chooses the word ancient. He's, again, why is John doing this? Because he's talking about how what Satan and his ilk do is a mimic. It's an imitation of what God does. And notice, it's not the word arche. He's an ancient serpent, but he's not from before the beginning. So he's from the beginning, the serpent, but he's not from before the beginning, because in the beginning, the word already was. God was, God is before the beginning. The serpent comes from the beginning onwards, but he's a Johnny come lately with respect to God, because God's been around before the beginning, which if you can figure that one out, then you have my respect, because I haven't got that one figured out. But he does this, and he casts him into He casts him into the abyss. Now, the abyss is a fairly rare word. We've already seen this in Revelation. The best I can do for you is to tell you it's a really deep pit. Okay, abusa is the word. And it seems to typically be related to water, that abysses exist in the seas. And the idea is that it's just this incredibly deep thing from which there's no escape. But he's there and he's bound. Now notice who casts him there. It's another angel. Satan is a fallen angel. Now an angel is the one bringing about his punishment. Christ came and destroyed Antichrist. Christ came and destroyed false prophet. Christ came and destroyed the armies. But here an angel, it isn't even Jesus dealing with the devil. Now it's just some angel who's got the chain. I mean, he's probably really important in heaven, but you get my point. And he bound him for 1,000 years. Now he is not cast into hell forever. Now this is what, I'm going to get pedantic here. You're going to get really annoyed with me, but I want you to pay attention. He bound him for 1,000 years. Pay attention to that. People who want to tell you that the 1,000-year reign is just, you know, something that's not really in the Bible, well, it's here. Well, let's see how many times it's there. He bound him for 1,000 years. So is Satan destroyed? No. Is Satan annihilated? No. Is Satan told that he'll never return? No. He's bound in the abyss for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the abyss, and he closed the seal over it so that he should not deceive the nations, so that Satan can't do anything bad until when? Until the 1,000 years should be finished. 1,000 years again. 1,000 years are going to be finished. Satan is going to be released. When? After the 1,000 years. After this, it is necessary to loose him a small time. I translated that very literally. They're saying he must be released for a small time. We'll get to why in a second. But here's what I want you to catch. Don't miss this. If you're a Lutheran, I assume none of you guys here are Lutherans, and I have many good Lutheran friends, so I'm not bashing the Lutherans. They're just really bad at this part of theology. If you're a Lutheran, you say, well, no, there is no millennial reign, Luke. That's referring to the reign of Jesus on this earth through his church. And I said, okay, well, when was Satan bound? I said, oh, Satan is bound. He is bound. Really? Really? Because he's not deceiving the nations right now? I'm sorry, friend. And then why is he going to be released later if he's bound now? Why is he going to, you know, they don't have good answers for this. It's not just Lutherans that don't have good answers, but you get my point here. Verse 4. Yeah, no, please, interrupt. Please. That is awesome. I have never seen that before. That is really cool. I think you're absolutely right. I think that is, that there is definitely a direct parallel. Satan is put in and sealed so that he can't deceive the nations and he can't get out. Jesus is put in the tomb and sealed. And why did they seal him? So that his disciples won't steal him away and fool the people. And in fact, I think it might be in Matthew's gospel where the priests tell Pilate the second deception will be worse than the first. And they actually use the word deception. So thank you. That is awesome. That is a really good catch. I'll have to you know, do a sermon on that and not give you any credit so everybody will think I'm smart. So it's no, that's really cool. Thank you. Yeah. Great observation. I kind of want to look into that and look at how John has used that. Verse 4. I saw the thrones. We've already seen thrones. We've seen them at the beginning, we've seen them in the middle, we're seeing them at the end. And why? Because John's concerned about rulership. The book of Revelation is all about rulership. The kingdom of this world is become the kingdom of our Lord. And judgment was given to them. Who's them? The ones upon the thrones. So it's thrones plural. Does God have multiple thrones? I mean, no, he has a throne. So the ones on the thrones, this is referring to the 24 elders. And the souls of the ones who are beheaded on account of the testimony of Jesus, on account of the word of God, and who didn't worship the beast, neither his image, and didn't take the mark upon the forehead or upon their hand, and they lived and they ruled with Christ 1,000 years. So who's ruling with Christ for 1,000 years? Definitely the 24 elders. Definitely those who were martyred during the tribulation. What about everybody else who was already raptured? See, here's I mentioned this months ago. This is why you can't have a pre-tribulation rapture. That's why it doesn't make any sense. If there was not a pre-tribulation, this is why you have to have a pre-tribulation rapture. This is why you can't have a rapture after the tribulation, a post-tribulation rapture. Is there a post-tribulation rapture? Yeah, there is. And it says specifically who's raptured in the post-tribulation rapture. It's the people who died, who gave their life for the testimony of Jesus, and who didn't receive the mark of the beast. And that these are clearly people who were martyred during the tribulation. Who are the ones at the wedding supper of the Lamb? Because the wedding supper of the Lamb happens way back previously. Who is there for that? How are the 24 elders going to rule on the earth in physical bodies if the 24 elders haven't already been raptured? So the only way that the 24 elders can be in heaven and then come down to earth and rule when it's not told that they're raised again is if they were already raptured in some previous event that John doesn't disclose for us. It doesn't make sense. What does make sense is there's a rapture that happens before the tribulation begins, and then at the end of the tribulation, those who died are also raised again so that they can be and they can rule with Christ. To me, that makes an awful lot of sense. But anyways, and they kinged, they ruled with Christ. For how long did they rule with Christ? For 1,000 years. That's the three times now we've seen the term 1,000 years. And the remaining of the dead did not live until the 1,000 years were finished. That's four times we've seen the expression 1,000 years. So not everybody is raised from the dead at this resurrection, at this rapture, this resurrection, whatever you want to call it. In fact, this isn't even really a rapture, maybe, because they're just raised from the dead. It doesn't even say they're taken up in the twinkling of an eye. So I know people who want to say that this is the rapture. I don't even think it meets the qualifications for a rapture, because it doesn't use the Greek word harpazo, so it doesn't meet that. And they're not taken up to be in heaven with Christ, so it doesn't meet that. It's not even a rapture. I was willing to grant the premise that it's a rapture, but it's not even a rapture. Okay, so this is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one having part in the first resurrection. Upon these, the second death does not have authority, but they will be priests of God and of the Christ and will king with him the 1,000 years. It's the fifth time we've seen the expression 1,000 years. Now, again, I don't want to beat dead horses, but how many times does he have to say 1,000 years before we think that maybe he's serious, that it will actually last 1,000 years? I don't know. Anyways, and when the 1,000 years are finished, that's six times, okay? John's not dropping the stick on this one, okay? When the 1,000 years are finished, the Satan will be loosed out of his prison, and he will go to deceive the nations from the four corners of the world, Gog and Magog, and they'll gather them to a war, and they'll be innumerable, and they'll go to the plains, and they'll go about the fortified camp of the holies of holies of the saints. And then God will destroy them. Okay, so we're gonna pause right there. I'm gonna go back. Here's the big question, and this is the question that everybody who doesn't take the book of Revelation literally, every single one of them, they all come back to this. This is the part that doesn't make sense to them, and this is where they try to attack Revelation as literal future prophecy. And they say, well, why would Jesus come and destroy Satan, destroy the Antichrist, or at least punish Satan, destroy Antichrist, destroy the false prophet, establish a kingdom in the world where Jesus is literally ruling and reigning, and do it for 1,000 years and then let Satan go? Why would God do that? It doesn't make any sense to them. So I'll pose the question to you. Why would God do that? Well, you know, there's a saying, there have been many chess masters, but there's never been a master of chess. And they say the same thing about theology. There have been many people with a master's, but nobody's mastered theology. So I put it to you. Just show of hands. Does anybody else think that maybe this doesn't make a whole lot of sense, letting Satan go again? Does it make sense to you? Okay. Okay, absolutely. People I know who are good and godly people say the exact same thing. And I don't mean to demean them or diminish them. I'm sure that I'm wrong about something. I haven't found it yet, but I'm sure that they disagree with me on a lot of stuff. That's fine. That is the point that they make. Satan's already been defeated. Why release him? Let's pause and ask a different question. He has not been thrown in the lake of fire yet. You're right. He's just in the abyss. He's not in the lake of fire. What I think that question ignores a more important question. That question is an important question. And don't get me wrong. It's a very important question. But the problem with that question is that it starts in the middle. It doesn't actually go back to the beginning. So if we go back to the beginning, there's a question that exists before that one, which is, why is Satan allowed to deceive the nations in the first place? Let me ask a second question that's parallel to that one. Did God have to, like, go to the gym and work out and exercise so that he would be strong enough to defeat Satan, and he only now, at this point in history, is he powerful enough to actually take him on and defeat him? Okay, you guys are laughing because it's a ridiculous question, right? Was there any point in history when God was not able to put Satan in the abyss? No, he has always had the ability to put Satan into the abyss. He's always had the ability to cast Satan into the lake of fire. So that question is, it's not a question of ability. He could have done it at any time. So why did he wait till now? Why did he let Satan loose in the first place? See, that's the question. When you ask the question, and I'm not saying this to pick on you, I'm saying this so we can think through this, because this is a complicated issue. Because the Bible doesn't give us an answer. It really doesn't. We have to do some theology on this. The question is, why, if you've defeated Satan, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, why do you let the deceiver of the nations go again? Why do you let him wreak more havoc? The only way to answer that question is to answer the question, which is, why did he let Satan loose in the first place? Why did he let Satan into the garden in the first place? If you can answer that question, whatever your answer to that question is will determine your answer to the second question. Yeah, I mean, I think to see who is going to be true and faithful. Now, I want to qualify that statement, because when you say to see who will be true and faithful, does God not know already who's going to be true and faithful? He does. He does. So when God tests people, it's not as though God is doing an experiment in his, you know, in his laboratory to see what happens because he doesn't know. It's because he is demonstrating it to us. So here's the where I fall out on this. And if you guys don't like this answer, that's fine. That's fine. A lot of people don't like this answer, but here's where I fall out. Our answer to why Satan is loosed after the 1,000 years depends on our answer to the question, why was Satan loosed in the garden? Why is Satan allowed to continue deceiving the nations and being a roaring lion walking about seeking whom he may devour? Why is Satan allowed to do that in the first place? I think the answer is really, really close to your answer to test who really loves him. In fact, I think that's essentially my answer. I would add a couple thoughts to that. It's not simply to test. It's to prove to us where our loves lie. One, it's to prove to us the necessity we have for God's grace. It's to prove to us our need for the Holy Spirit to dwell within us. And lastly, it is to prove to the world that God is not unjust in judging. And here's the reason why I say that. Humanity exists under ideal conditions for 1,000 years. We can go back. We're not going to tonight, but you can go back and read Isaiah 66. You can read other passages that talk about, just go on the internet and look up, you know, verses about the millennium, and you'll find them and you'll read about them, and they're really nice. I look forward to it. I was serious, and he laughed at that one. But yes, I look forward to the millennium. If that's true, that for 1,000 years, human beings live under perfect ideal conditions, where there is righteous government, where God is present, where God is visible, people can actually go and see God face to face. So there's actually really not a need for faith in something you can't see. Your faith will be faith in what you can see. You know, it doesn't mean it's not faith. Right? Like Jesus says, blessed are you believe because you've seen, but blessed are those who will believe without seeing. So seeing is believing. It doesn't make it not faith. It just means that it's a different kind of faith. But they'll be there. God will be present. God will be making life awesome. Everything will be good. They're ideal conditions for humanity. And what does humankind do? They still rebel against God. What excuse do they have? They have none. They have no excuse whatsoever. The very moment that Satan is released, he is able to deceive the nations, and people say, yeah, you know what? God's a jerk. Let's rebel. Why would you do that? Why would you do that? My answer goes back to what Deanne said, and this is the answer of theologians throughout history. The problem with humanity is that our loves are disordered. We should love God the most. We should love God more than ourselves. We should love God more than our spouses, our parents, anything in this world. But we don't. We love other things more than God. That's the fundamental problem with humanity. So that was a lot of me talking about a lot of stuff. But that really, I think, is important. Because as we're coming to the close of the book of Revelation, we're trying to figure out why God is doing what he's doing. John doesn't give us the why. John gives us the what, and we need to do theology to figure out the why. Now, sometimes in the Bible, we're given the why, and then we have to do theology to figure out the what. But here, it's the other way. John says, God's going to do this, 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 and this, and this. And we're saying, well, why is he doing that? Because people say, well, why the thousand-year reign? A lot of people say, why a thousand-year reign? Why not just go into perfect eternity? Well, I don't know. Maybe there were people who didn't believe yet who still lived in the world. I don't know that there are, but, you know, what about maybe God just loves life and he wants more generations of human beings to be born. He wants 1,000 years of people living under ideal conditions. I think that's a pretty good thing. Maybe human beings won't be born in the eternal state. Maybe there will be no more humans who are born. Because a lot of people believe the number of angels is fixed. You know, there are only so many angels. God isn't in the business of making more angels. The number of angels is the number of angels. At some point, presumably, the number of humans will be the number of humans. There'll be no more humans. God's going to break the mold. And there are going to be no more. So maybe God wants 1,000 years of people being born under ideal conditions. I think that's a good thing. So, yeah, it's, why does God do this? Also, a lazy answer is because he wants to fulfill the promises he's made in the Old Testament, but that's a lazy answer because it kind of avoids the question. But it's a clever way to avoid the question, and so it's useful. But we're here in chapter 20. We're finishing up. They come down, and this goes back to your question earlier, Connie. Who is Gog and Magog? Who are these people? I don't know. I don't know. Is this the first war of Gog and Magog? Are there two wars of Gog and Magog? Is all of the material in Ezekiel 38 and 39 referring to this event, or is it divided? Don't know. Have no idea. I would tend to say, again, like I said, I don't like the idea that there are two wars of Gog and Magog, but it makes the best sense of the evidence, and so I hold to it loosely. But if I found a better answer, I'd probably get rid of it pretty quickly because I don't like it, because it's not easy to split up Ezekiel into two parts. It's not really organic. And in the Bible, when you're doing Bible study, if you're trying to divide something that doesn't divide easily, you should only divide it if you have to. But anyways, that's another story for another day. Absolutely. Please ask. Yes.
Everything is great.
Yes.
Now, we're going to turn Satan loose for a short period. And he's going to come down and get all these people.
From the four corners of the earth. I'm just reading the text.
But if we had lived in a paradise situation where God had ordered all these people.
Is your question like geographically where, or how did they come about to do it? Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. So you're saying, how do they even mount a rebellion? How do they? God permits them to. That's the best answer I have. It's not a great answer, but God lets them. Absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely true. He will appeal to the narcissist. Honestly, Jim, that's a question that I've asked myself many times, and I'm like, well, wait a second. How do you actually begin an armed revolt against God when God is sitting on the throne? I don't know how. I think here's what it comes down to for me. I agree, but I'm not going to say that on this. I think here's what it comes down to for me. Have you guys ever watched your kids doing something that you knew and they knew they weren't supposed to do, and you just wanted to see how long they would do it? I think that's kind of what might be happening here. Obviously, nothing happens without God knowing about it. But Satan convinces them to do it anyways, and then what happens when you don't stop somebody in the first instance? They get bolder. You know, it's the old dip your toe in the water thing. You dip your toe in the water, oh, well, that's not too bad. I'm going to put my whole foot in. Oh, well, I can deal with that. And then you jump in. Well, I think that's what's happening here. It's basic human nature. God permits them, and they take God's permission as God's impotence. They confuse his kindness for weakness. And what it does is God gives them enough rope to hang themselves. Now, you might say, well, golly, that doesn't sound very nice of God. Shouldn't he just slap their hands right away? No. What? They've had 1,000 years. Like, there's 1,000 years of history of knowing that God judges evil and God does good. What more evidence do you need? But like you said, Satan's appealing to the narcissist. All these people who think that they could do it better, or they don't like living under God's rule. I mean, how did a third of the angels fall? If this confuses you, if this upsets your theology, then you got a bigger problem, which is how did a third of the angels fall with Satan? They knew God face to face. We don't. They knew God in the sense that we can't even comprehend, and they rebelled against God. This doesn't upset me at all. This doesn't bother me. To me, this fits perfectly well in what I know of human nature. Yeah, excellent point. Adam and Eve knew God. God walked with them in the cool of the day. He knew God by voice. Although there were only like two people, so it's not like he could be. He's like, hey, is that the snake talking again? It doesn't sound like snake. Yeah, so I don't know. Yes, yeah, absolutely. It takes two to tango, but it doesn't take any more than that. So it's. What does God do? He of course, as Jim said, he zaps them, and they're cast. Satan is cast in the lake of fire and sulfur, and they're tormented day and night into the ages of the ages. I haven't said much about this. We'll say a little bit more about it later. But this expression, the ages of the ages. Now, Rob Bell wrote a book a few years ago. Now, you guys probably are familiar with Rob Bell. Rob Bell wrote a book essentially denying a literal hell or an eternal hell. I think that was the big thing I read a lot of Rob Bell. He wrote a book called Love Wins. So if you're not familiar with it, I wouldn't bother reading it. But it really like made a lot of people angry, which I thought was odd because Rob Bell had said a lot of disturbing things before he wrote that book. And actually, maybe one of the least offensive things he ever did was write the book Love Wins. A lot of Christian theologians throughout history have doubted an eternal hell. The fancy here, let me give you the $5 theological term, eternal conscious torment. Most theologians don't use the expression hell. They don't use it because hell is a Germanic word, and it doesn't neatly fit onto lake of fire or Hades or place of torment. It doesn't fit into. So most theologians, they call ECT. They say, do you believe in ECT, eternal conscious torment? A lot of really good theologians, and I'm not suggesting you follow them here, but a lot of really good theologians that nobody would criticize have said, I don't believe in ECT. I don't believe in eternal conscious torment. John Stott said a lot of wonderful things, and I really love John Stott. Wish he hadn't said that, but he did say it. A lot of people, a lot of really good scholars throughout history have tended towards what's called annihilationism, which is people spend some time in hell, but eventually their souls are annihilated. Some people like Rob Bell believe in what's called universalism, which is that, yes, people will go to hell, but the purging fires will purge away the sin. They will come to regret that they'll regret their decisions and they'll repent and they'll turn to God. And in the end, love wins. Now, I would love to believe that. That would be wonderful. It's not. But it's not in there. But it's speculation. And one of the arguments that Bell makes, and this is it's not a good argument, but this is the argument he makes, which is that the word ion, or we call it eon, we've translated the word eon. The ion just means an age. It doesn't mean forever. Hebrew and Greek, neither of them have a word forever. English has a word forever. They don't have it. So that's why John uses this expression, the ages of the ages, or unto the ages of the ages. That's in Hebrew, it's olam va'olam. Olam means like an extremely long period of time. Olam va'olam. age and the ages and ages. And so Rob Bell says, well, wait a second. It doesn't say that they will go to hell forever. It just says they'll go to hell for ages. Okay, yeah, but it also says that life is aionios, eonish. It's eon life. So if eternal punishment is only temporary, then so is eternal life. The problem that Bell has is that sword cuts both ways. The other problem Bell has is there is no actual word in Koine Greek that really means forever. You either have to accept that the word forever can mean a very long time or forever, or you have to accept that the phrase ages of the ages was an idiomatic way of saying forever. Here's another thing. How many of you have used the word forever and not actually literally meant forever? How many of you have ever been confused about whether somebody meant forever or just a really long time? You have never been confused about that, right? If you've said, oh man, I haven't had ice cream in forever, I'm guessing that you have either never had ice cream or you haven't had it in a really long time, right? No one is confused about that. No one's confused about that. So again, I would refer Bell to a course in biblical Greek. It would do him a lot of good. But anyways, I'm not here to beat up on him. So we've got all this material. I'm going a little bit over time. I can't promise it'll be worth it, but I'm going a little bit over time. Verses 11 and following. This is this end part, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. We've already talked about this before. But there's the great white throne judgment. Now, this word is thronos. There are two words that mean a throne in biblical Greek. Biblical Greek. Thronos and bema. Bema is a seat of it's called a bema seat. There's a throne, which we've seen that word throughout the entire book of Revelation. A throne is a place of judgment and authority. A bema is also a throne, but typically a bema is used to grant gifts. So it's there's some difference. Some people dispute that, but if you're interested in that, look up the difference between thronos and bema, and then take it with a gigantic grain of salt, because there's some stuff there. But there's a great white throne. Now, there have been many thrones. There's been the throne of God. There have been many thrones. But now we have a great white throne. This is something completely different than what we've seen before. And the one sitting upon it, again, notice how John does this. It's really interesting, and I mentioned this before, but John identifies the item and then the one sitting upon it. He doesn't say, I saw one sitting upon a great white throne. He says, I saw a great white throne and the one sitting upon it. It's kind of a fun play on words. But, and from his face, the heaven and the earth fled, and a place was not found for them. Okay, now, if you believe that the earth will be totally destroyed, and that, like Peter says, that the elements will melt in fire, this is the only place you're going to fit it in the book of Revelation. This is your place. So if you agree, if you read that part of Peter very literally, that the elements will melt with heat, everything's going to go away, here's your best place to fit that in. Do with that what you want. But heaven and earth fled from him. And this is I think the take that C.S. Lewis does. If you've ever read the Narnia series, I don't know if you guys read Narnia with your kids, in the last battle, at the judgment, they're all judged. They go into a special room, and then there's a judgment, and then they enter the new Narnia. Lewis seems to take that view, that at this great white throne judgment, everybody's taken to like some special place, and the old heaven and earth are destroyed, and then God creates a new one. I'm not opposed to that theory. It's just the best place to fit it. So anyways, and he saw the dead, the great and the small, and there stood before the throne, and the books were opened. Okay, and then another book was opened, which is the book of life. Okay, so there are books. The books, plural, that were opened presumably are books that refer to people's works, what they have done in their life, good and bad. Because God is able to make a big enough book to have all the information, whether it's actually a literal book or not. But presumably that there are books of good deeds and books of evil deeds. But then there's a third book, at least a third book. There could be a thousand books, I don't know. But then there's at least a third book. And the third book is the book of life. Now the interesting thing is, the dead were judged out of the things that are written in the books according to their works. So everybody's judged according to their works. If you did good things, you're judged according to the good things. If you've done bad things, and we've all done good and bad things, and everybody's judged according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead, and et cetera, et cetera. And death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. So everybody, all the people that were alive at the time, all the people who were dead were resurrected. This is the general resurrection. This is a great white throne judgment. This is general resurrection. They're judged because death, Hades, and the sea, they all give up. They're dead. And death and Hades are cast in the lake of fire. But then we get verse 15. And if someone was not found written in the book of life, he was cast in the lake of fire. Now notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say that if someone didn't have a lot of good deeds, a lot of good works, they were cast in the lake of fire. No, they were judged according to their works, but whether they went to the lake of fire or whether they went to the new heavens and the new earth depended on one and only one thing, which is if their name was written in the book of life. So people, this is where a lot of, I'll be honest, a lot of theologians get really uncomfortable with me. A lot of evangelicals get really uncomfortable with me because I say you most certainly will be judged according to your works, and your works most certainly matter. And then they say, whoa, Luke, whoa. You sound like you're reverting to your old Catholic days. No, I'm not reverting to my old Catholic days. I'm reverting to my Bible reading days, right? So you are judged according to your works. All of us will be. All of us will have to answer for our works. We will be judged according to them, but we will also be judged according to whether or not our names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And that is ultimately what matters. Paul says it very clearly in Corinthians chapter 10. All of us are going to be judged according to our works, saved and the unsaved. Christians will be judged according to their works, and they will receive rewards according to their works. And some are going to be saved as though through fire. They're going to be saved by the skin of their teeth. They're not going to have any works to their name. And you know, the fire is going to test the quality of their work, and everything they had was wood, hay, and stubble. They're not going to have any gold, not going to have any silver, not going to have any jewels. I think you guys all know, people that you've met like that, and you're like, golly, they say all the right things, but I wouldn't want to be standing in their place on Judgment Day. You know, you guys all know people like that, right? Some of us know a lot of people like that. Some of us, you know, maybe some of us are the people that way, and we're like, I don't know anybody like that. What are you talking about? Well, it's probably you. Okay, so. What's that? Little at a sheltered life, yeah. So, yeah, that is very true. And so what do we have? We have this very simple principle. You're saved by grace through faith. You're saved unto works. This is what Paul says in Ephesians. You're saved unto works, to do the good works which God prepared in advance for us to do. And again, this is demonstrated here in the book of Revelation. My answer to that would be, okay, so the question is, people who are saved, when we're judged according to our works, are we judged according to the works from before we were saved or after? I would say all of our lives. All of our lives. And part of the reason I would say that is we have the parable of the talents. So there are two parables that deal with rewards and judgment. There's the parable of the workers in the vineyard, and then there's the parable of the 10 talents, or the 10 minas, if you're using Luke's gospel. And both of them are important. We have to hold both of them in tension. The parable of the talents says you will be rewarded according to your effectiveness in the kingdom. The parable of the workers in the vineyard says you're going to receive the same reward no matter how long you worked in the vineyard. The parable of the workers in the vineyard is referring, in my the way that I can make sense of this is everyone receives salvation. Everyone receives grace. It doesn't matter if they come to Christ at 9 years old or 99 years old. You are a child of God. There are no super duper saints. That doesn't come in gradations. However, God rewards people according to their faithfulness and effectiveness in the kingdom. There is hierarchy. All of human existence has hierarchy. We're not going to get rid of hierarchy in heaven. There are going to be saints who are much, much higher ranking than me. There may be a couple saints that are lower ranking than me. I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know. But there are going to be hierarchies and ranks in heaven based upon your devotion to Christ and your faithfulness to Him. I firmly believe there are going to be people who you have never heard of and I have never heard of, and they're going to have very important roles to fulfill in the kingdom. because they were faithful. Nobody ever knew them. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be mothers of, you know, mothers of 10 children from Vietnam who are going to be reigning at a very high rank in heaven, and they're going to be, you know, mega church pastors who are going to be down, you know, picking up dog poop in heaven. I'm not saying, well, maybe dogs won't poop in heaven. I don't know. But it wouldn't be Bryan, Ohio, I'll tell you that. You know, so anyways, maybe I'm getting off track. I certainly am. But yeah, anyways, I'll shut up. Did that answer your question, or at least attempt to? Okay, good. Yes, ma'am. Yes. You're right. No woman is going to be cast in the lake of fire because of the way Luke chose to translate pronouns. That's what it means. You know what? I will say this. There people make a big deal of the pronouns, and I said this years ago. I was preaching. I said, look, if you get mad that God is always referred to as a man, just remember the church is always referred to as a woman. You know, like, and the church is kind of a nice thing. So, anyways, and yeah, the default pronoun is male, so no ladies are going there. But anyways. Anything else you guys have? All right. Thank you guys very much. God bless you.